It's great to have you back with us this afternoon. We have just sort of been skimming along, hitting the tops of subjects that I really wish I had an hour or two apiece to work through with you. But I appreciate the questions, the comments that you've made in the times in between our sessions together. And we pray that as you reflect on the things we've said, you will find a deeper and deeper sense of your mission as leaders and shepherds, and in that deeper sense of mission, more adequate tools for doing the job that you are committed to doing. Yesterday we began really a two-day series that it's hard to determine where yesterday's subject leaves off and today's subject picks up. Because we were talking largely about shepherding in times of change yesterday, and today we're talking about shepherding in times of conflict, and usually those two are running at about the same time, if your experience parallels mine. I really do want to talk about some things that need to happen, though, in the specific realm of congregational conflict, some strategies we pursue, some agendas that we try to maintain, some priorities we try to promote. Because human nature is that we do get at odds with one another. It's inevitable that we're going to get at odds with one another. The goal of leadership is to be perceptive enough that when we are at odds with one another, that we find a way still to work together and to be together. When we were putting together the book, System Sensitive Leadership, one of the quotes that I put in one of the statements I made in the first chapter, and was surprised at how many reviewers across the denominational world pick up this one quote and highlighted it in their reviews of the book, was that even though we admire the leader who can take a congregation or organization that's in conflict and resolve the conflict and reunite it, in many ways, far more visionary is the leader who sees the conflict coming and finds a way to defuse it before it ever occurs. Someone who is using their sensory acuity, as we were talking about Thursday, to really hear what's going on and to know people well enough and to know their people specifically well enough to anticipate what may be coming and prepare to deal with it. And so as we talk about conflict today, I want to begin by talking about some things that don't have to do with conflict itself, but setting the frame that helps us deal with conflict or avoid conflict or prevent conflict more effectively. I have the blessing of working with a church that is 9 years old and has never had a church fight. There aren't too many of those around. But one of the great blessings that comes out of it is now then there is a culture there that we don't settle things by fighting. The idea that sort of pervades the culture is, we've never had a church fight and I'm not going to start the first one. Now, when you've got that kind of mindset running in your congregation, there's a lot of room for maneuver and change and experimentation. I would recommend that you start looking for ways to try to create that mindset. Well, how would you do that? I think there are two or three things that we have to continually preach and teach on in order to have that kind of frame. First of all, I think it's imperative for us in the restoration movement to constantly be reminding people of what the essentials are. When the restoration movement was first in its infancy in 1809, and Thomas Campbell wrote the Declaration and Address, which was more or less the Magna Carta that got this whole effort at restoring New Testament Christianity in the United States started. That document was so influential, it was reprinted more than any other document or sermon out of the Restoration Movement for the next 30 years, and not just by a slight margin, but many times over, it was the most published document. And in it, he sort of laid out a sketch of how we could go about finding unity among those who were divided into various denominational camps of the day. And one of the things that he emphasized is that our unity is based on the absolute essentials of the faith.
that there are a lot of other things that are doctrine and are true doctrine, and we need to be clear and teach those things, but they are part of, and I have always loved this term, they are part of the after edification of the church. That's his phrase. They are about what you use to build up the believers who are saved and already together. But it's not those doctrines that are essential for unity. The doctrines that are essential for unity, the doctrines that make us one, need to be put on a higher plane than the things that are important for, to use Campbell's word again, the after edification of the church. Many times I find when I'm dealing with conflict is that people put all doctrines on an even plane. That all doctrines are of equal significance. What you believe about the role of women is as important as what you believe about the deity of Christ. And that's a failure on our part to be true to something that was part of our heritage from the very beginning. Because one of the mottos that was part of the early restoration movement was, in essentials, unity. In other matters, liberty. In all matters, charity, goodwill, love. And so we started off by saying we want to make a distinction between what are the essentials and what are the less important issues. Not unimportant issues. There are some, in the realm of essentials, we do not compromise. There is one Lord, one God over all. The Bible is our authoritative guide for what we're about. Jesus is His incarnate Son, resurrected and reigning today as Lord of heaven and earth. There are absolutes that we do not hesitate to draw a line on. But are you clear as to what the real essentials are and what the other important doctrines are? Is your congregation clear on that? It's very important when conflict comes that we be reminded that we're together on the basis of the essentials, not because we are in agreement are of one accord on some things that are not part of the essentials. Secondly, and closely related to this, there needs to be a great deal of preaching on the grand truths, the grand doctrines of the faith. And this is bigger than just the essentials. I say this because it's the way that the Apostle Paul seems to have dealt with conflict. Have you ever noticed how many of Paul's letters were written because of problems that had surfaced in a congregation, and he was writing to deal with that problem? Now, back away from the specific texts for a moment, or the specific issues, step back far enough to look at how procedurally, structurally, the Apostle Paul dealt with those situations. What he would do is disengage himself from the immediate problem and start reminding them of the grand truths that pull us together. The things that give us a whole new identity as God's holy people. The things that make us transcendent beyond this world, having the hope of life eternal. And he lifted their vision, as it were, to be reminded of the big truths. Because guess what had happened to their vision? It was turned down and focused in on this little thing that you and I can't agree about. And before Paul ever got into that matter, he wanted to get them back on the right plateau spiritually. He wanted their vision where it needed to be. And so he preached the grand doctrines, the grand themes. And I'm not saying there's no room for dealing with specific issues or specific texts that deal with a narrow aspect of Christianity. But that must not be allowed in our Bible school classes, from our pulpits, in our small group experiences, to become the primary focus of our teaching. We need to be calling people back to the grand truths that lift their vision and lift them up and get us to realizing, hey, we're together up here. We can find a way to deal with this difference down here. We're of one spirit up here. We can find a way to handle this difference here. And I'm yet to find myself being invited to help a congregation work through a conflict that people are focused on the grand doctrines that unite them together. That simply got lost someplace. The third thing that I think we need to emphasize quite often from our teaching and preaching is, whose church is it? I hear an awful lot of people in conflict say, well, My church is never going to do that. I thought it was Jesus' church. The question isn't really what I would like this church to do or what it would be most comfortable for me if this church would do. The issue is, what would Jesus do with this church right now if he were standing here telling us what his will is for this church? Because it is, after all, his. And the thing that is striking about the way Jesus went about his ministry is that he made a lot of people uncomfortable when he challenged their way of doing church. And I have a feeling he would challenge us as well. But we need to be reminding people that it is Jesus' church, and he has an agenda for us to reach the lost. And if his agenda is for us to reach the lost, what are things we may need to be doing differently that will make me a bit uncomfortable? I can tell you. We do a lot of things at my congregation that are not my preference. But it is what connects with the people we're trying to reach. And the Apostle Paul said, I became all things to all men so that by some means I might win some. I think that means that maybe I can sing some music that's not my first preference. I think that means I can listen to a sermon in a style that's not what I would prefer to hear. I think that means that we could schedule our services at some times that might be convenient for the folk we're trying to reach rather than of optimal convenience to me. If we are committed to it being Christ's church and that I'm willing to do all things so that for all men's benefit, so that by some means I can win some, then all of a sudden we don't have quite so many little issues to fight about. So that's just a preliminary. Be setting that frame so that when conflict comes along, we can remind people of these things and call them back to the spirit of grandness that God has called us to in the church. But you're here because you're wanting to know what to do when the conflict breaks out. When it has erupted, how do we go forward? I want to first of all begin by talking to you about what has to happen in the wake of conflict if your resolution of conflict is going to be a lasting resolution. There are three things that have to come out of the way you resolve that conflict, or the odds are it will in time reappear, perhaps in a different guise, but the same struggle will remanifest itself. There are three things that must be satisfied in the minds of all those who are parties to this conflict in order for you to have a lasting agreement. First of all, there has to be what we call procedural agreement, procedural satisfaction. People have to believe, when all is finished, that the process you used for settling this difference was fair, that everybody got a hearing, that it was not some imposition, a unilateral decision by leadership, that there was genuine dialogue. Every time we set out to solve a problem of conflict, we have to choose some process by which we do it. Now, there was a time, just a few decades ago, when much conflict could be dealt with simply by the elders issuing what we're going to do as a form of a statement, an edict, a declaration, and most people made their peace with it. The reason that's the case, to go back to what we were talking about yesterday from the book on system-sensitive leadership, at that time in our history, the vast majority of the people in the pew and the vast majority of the people in our community were coming out of what we call a System 4 mindset in this book. In System 4, the whole approach is one of maintaining order and maintaining structure and not letting things get out of control or letting things loose so that the bad guys take over. And in that world, whoever the leader is gets the right to make the decision. Because he has that title, he gets to make the decision as to what we will do, and we then submit our preferences to that decision and go along with it. As a result of that system, system four, being the dominant system in churches and communities throughout the early history of this country, elderships developed sort of a mindset that when a problem comes up, they get them together among themselves, they discuss what they think about this, what the solution should be, and they announce the decision. And there was a time that worked. It doesn't work in most churches today. Because today's churches have a lot of System 5 and a lot of System 6 and in some cases System 7 people sitting there, and they expect a participative approach to problem solving. I tell you how they look at the life of the church, particularly System 5. System 5 doesn't see authority inherent in the eldership. Listen to this. System 5 tends to see authority inherent in the congregation and entrusted to the eldership. Now think of the difference of that. System 5 tends to see authority inherent in the congregation, not in the eldership, and the congregation has entrusted its inherent authority to the eldership. You say, well, how could anybody defend a notion like that? Let me ask you a simple question. Imagine a congregation with no elders. Can they send out a missionary? Yeah. Can they hire a minister? Yeah. Can they discipline an unruly member? Yeah. Can they remove a Bible school teacher who is teaching something that is false doctrine? Yeah. Can they start a relief effort in the community? Yeah. Question for you. What is there that a church can do after it has an eldership that it couldn't do before it had an eldership? And it's hard to find anything, isn't there? Well, where did they get the authority to do all of those things? System 5 would say the authority is inherent in the life of the body. Now, when the elders come along, you don't add any more authority to the congregation. You simply entrust those men with exercising the congregational authority. Now then, guess who the elders are answerable to in a System 5 mindset? The body. System 4 views an eldership as answerable only to God. System 5 sees it as answerable to God and the body. That God has given them the authority, but God has passed it through the mediation of the congregation. So when you start announcing a decision from a System 4 standpoint, and you have not brought System 5 into the discussion of the issues and listened to their perspectives, they're going to tend to say, this was not a fair process. This was not even a legitimate process. This was not even a biblical process. This wasn't a Christian process. They believe that everyone who's going to be affected by the resolution needs a voice, not a vote, a voice. Please hear the difference there. System 5 will go along with a decision that doesn't support their viewpoint so long as they feel the process was fair, so long as they feel the procedures were balanced and carefully managed. And so, first of all, when you start thinking about how we're going to solve this conflict, we have to focus on procedural satisfaction. How can we go at this so everyone is going to come out of it saying, yes, the process was open, it was honest, and it was fair? Secondly, we have to work on the issue of psychological satisfaction. That is, that the principals in this conflict feel when it is over that they were treated with dignity, that they were treated with respect, that they were genuinely listened to, that they are fully valued as part of this body, that they were considered worthwhile in the dialogue. Their views were worthwhile. There needs to be psychological satisfaction on the part of all of the people involved. The last thing you want when things are already polarized is for someone to feel like, boy, they really gave me the backhand of fellowship. You know, they really put me down when I voiced my concerns. And so you want to be sure that you are careful to respect the psychological needs of each group. Now, it's at that point that a lot of the things in our book here and the description of systems 4, 5, and 6, the three systems that are primarily in conflict today, come into play. Because they have significantly different needs internally that they want to be addressed in any settlement of conflict that we're about. For instance, for System 4, the overarching concern above everything else is truth. For System 5, truth is important, but System 5 is also very concerned about doing it better and doing it more effectively. System 5 says if we're doing it for the Lord, we ought to do it the best way possible. If we're doing it for the Lord, we ought to do it as effectively as possible. Now, we may have been doing it this way all along, but we see a better way to do it, and we want to pursue a better way to do it. System 6 is not looking so much for a better way, but a kinder way. It's looking for an atmosphere in which we don't victimize anyone, we're sensitive to the hurts and needs of everyone, and there's an inclusion of even those who are on the fringe as valued parties to our body. And you can already begin to see, with no more than that brief description of these three groups, that what it's going to take to satisfy them psychologically is quite different from one to another. They have a whole different psychological agenda that is running when they come into conflict. So we've got procedural satisfaction we need to pursue. We've got psychological satisfaction we need to pursue. And then third thing, and what we're working toward in all of this, is what we call the product satisfaction, the outcome. Everyone's got to be supportive of the outcome. If they're not, we're simply going to prolong the conflict. The problem is that we sometimes get so oriented first on getting to the proper outcome that we forget about proper process and honoring the psychological satisfaction of the individuals. My experience is that if you put your emphasis first on being sensitive to the felt needs of the people, and you become sensitive to a process that is fair, and you draw people into the dialogue, you multiply many times over the likelihood that whatever the outcome is, everybody will support it. See? We sort of get the cart before the horse because we want to get this conflict over as quickly as possible, so we tend to focus first on the solution. But in fact, I have found that there are all kinds of solutions that are far from ideal that all the parties will respect and support if the psychological and procedural satisfaction have been taken care of on the front end. In that regard, as we are working toward bringing about procedural satisfaction, let's return to a model we were using yesterday out of the field of mediation. Some of you were not with me, so let me just sort of quickly sketch this for you. Whenever we have conflict, there is an issue that is standing boldly before us. And parties have taken positions on either side of this issue. And now they're lobbing their artillery over the issue at one another. And it's at this point that you as a shepherd come into the picture to try to resolve this animosity and hatred that is developing. And I suggested yesterday that the first thing you want to do is to be clear on what the issue is, and be sure they are clear on what the issue is, because the issue has a way of changing as time goes by. Let's get real clear as to what the issue is. Let's get it down in 25 words or less. This is what we're fighting about, okay? Now then, let's get clear as to what the positions are. This is your position, this is your position. Let's get that down in as few words as possible. Let's be clear as to what the positions are, because positions also have a way of shifting. Okay. Now then that we know the positions and the issues, we draw a line underneath the issue and the positions, and we don't talk about the things above the line for a while. What we do is we go beneath the line and we start saying to the individual, this is your position. Tell me what concerns you have that are behind that position. What are the concerns you have that are behind that position? And we start listening to the concerns over here, and we start listening to the concerns over here. And do you know what we start discovering after a while? That there are a lot of shared concerns. That the people on both sides of this issue have many overlapping concerns. And it's amazing what happens when the two warring parties start hearing the other one talk about concerns that I have. All of a sudden, we're a lot closer together than we thought we were. You see, when we start lobbing artillery over the issue at one another, immediately, if you're on one side of the issue and I'm on the other side, what do I perceive your position as being? If he and I are fighting, I perceive his position as being all the way back there in the back row. When we get at odds with one another, we tend to see the other person as being much more different from us than we are. Now, there's a reason for that. Going back to Thursday, I talked about the way that the mind first sorts information in a millisecond after information comes in. And there are about 24, 25 major sorts outside of conscious awareness running deep in the unconscious mind that we all go through the second information comes into us. And you're sitting here sorting on what I'm saying, doing that very thing, those very things. One of those sorts that we talked about on Thursday is sorting by difference or sorting by sameness. When I ask you to describe three things, do you primarily, first of all, see how they're alike and then notice their differences? Or do you primarily notice their differences and then see how they're alike? Now, there are some people, about 5 to 10% of the population, who don't mix it, sort on sameness and then some on difference, or primarily on difference and then some on sameness. About 5 or 10% at each end of the spectrum sort only on difference and others only on sameness. Have you ever dealt with someone that no matter what you say, there's something wrong with it? No matter what's going wrong, there's some way to pick at it. All they can see is what's wrong. Okay? They're part of that little minority that sorts only on difference. Now, fortunately, about 80 to 85% of our people are going to either be people who sort first by sameness and then difference, or they sort first by difference and then sameness. But we all can go either way on that thing. And guess what you and I do when we get in fights with one another? Which of those do we start going to when we talk about one another? We start moving towards sorting by difference. Here's how I'm different from you guys. Oh, and I see something else that's different. And I see something else. And I keep throwing the differences into the equation until I sense us being much further apart than we really are. As long as we are talking about the issue and the problems and lobbying artillery over the issue, we're playing to that tendency to sort by difference. And a sort by difference always pushes us further and further apart. What happens when we draw the line and start talking about the concerns beneath the line, and we start identifying the fact that, hey, we've got a lot of overlapping concerns, we've just forced people to start sorting by sameness instead of by difference. You see what you're doing? Now remember, I said from the very beginning, we're talking about the things that you're doing down below the decks, not what's happening up on the deck. One of the challenges for leadership when conflict erupts is to get people away from sorting by difference and get them to start sorting by sameness. How are we alike? What are the things we have in common? What is the shared heritage we have? What are the things that we're still shoulder to shoulder on, though we can't see eye to eye on this? Now, that was behind what I said earlier when I talked about how you preach and teach in advance. To have loaded into people, I mean loaded into people, the grand doctrines of the faith. I followed by a number of years John Bannister, and the older generation here will know John's name because he was one of the legendary ministers in our brotherhood in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. One of the most eloquent orators that we've ever produced. A silver-tongued speaker if there ever was one. John was in that pulpit for 23 years. And then there were three other ministers in between his service and my service. And when I came there, he was still in the pew and continued there until just about 4 years ago when stroke took him. People give me credit for having been able to make a lot of change in an old traditional congregation that was on the edge of downtown and was starting to die like so many inner city congregations were dying. And we turned that thing around and revived that congregation by making some strategic and studied changes in the way we went at ministry. And a lot of people give me credit for pulling that off, but I can tell you who really deserves the credit. John Bannister deserves a ton of the credit for the preaching he did in the 50s and 60s, because it was a message of grace It was a message of the resurrection. It was a message of hope. It was a message in the confidence of your standing before God. It was a message of the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. John was one of the first in our brotherhood to start preaching the power of the indwelling Spirit in you personally. And what happened is, all that preaching he did in the 50s and 60s, and just inculcating these grand, great truths into the lives of people, then created the atmosphere that when I came along and we were making changes, people could see that they were minor, not major. That they were in the realm of opinion and preference, not in the realm of essential doctrine. So you never know when you're going to need to draw on that heritage of preaching the great themes and preaching the great truths and really underscoring what the essentials absolutely are. And when you've got that in place, then when you're down here sorting on difference and lobbing artillery at one another, you've got the ability to appeal back to that and begin to bring people back to a sort by sameness. But in the more immediate situation, what we're trying to do is to compare the various concerns they have. For instance, we had a conflict recently in which it was a very small thing, comparatively speaking. Two or three families over here, two or three families over here, and they were all saying, you know, if this goes a certain way, I'm going to have to leave, and we didn't want to lose any of them. So we tried to work through what the driving concerns were. These were older families. One was on one side and the other on the other side of a change we were about to make. When we sat down with them and asked, what is your primary concern? This party over here said, my primary concern is that this church still be here for my grandchildren. She had grandchildren just coming into the church, down in the cradle roll. And the other person said, well, let me tell you what my primary concern is. My primary concern is that this church here be for my grandchildren. Oh? All of a sudden, these two women who had been fighting had the same primary driving concern. Except that one felt the church needed to do one thing in order to survive. The other thought the church needed to do something different to survive. But all of a sudden, the intensity of their argument dampened down because they both knew they were pulling for the same thing. You see what I mean? You want to get people pulling for the same thing. Now then, two things will come out of this discussion of our common concerns. Once this woman wants the church to be here for her grandchildren, and this woman wants the church to be here for her grandchildren, then we can say, okay, what are the things the two of you see we could do to accommodate your other concerns? Because it's not just one concern, it's a whole stack of concerns. Okay, you want the church to be here for your grandchildren. What are your other concerns? Boom, 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 boom. What are your other concerns? Boom, 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 boom. Again, there's some overlap, there's some differences. But now then, each one can see the other's concerns, and when we say to them, okay, how could we come up with something that would achieve what we need to achieve by way of unity and address the concerns of everyone involved? Many times they come up with a solution we would have never seen. See, that's the beauty of bringing the parties into this and getting below the level of the issue and the combat to their concerns, because once they start coming back together and they're looking for a way to make this thing work, they will often see solutions that you and I would never see. And one of the reasons we wouldn't see them is because we wouldn't know all the concerns down there. We might be tempted to impose a solution that still left them unsatisfied because we didn't know what the concerns were. The second thing that happens when we can set aside the issue and the positions for a while and talk about the concerns is that we may find that we cannot resolve the issue. I'm not suggesting to you that we can resolve every issue. Paul and Barnabas finally got to the point, they said, this personnel issue is bigger than the both of us. I'm going to take Silas, Paul says, and go to Asia Minor. Barnabas, if you want to work with John Mark, you take him and go to Alexandria. That's what church history tells us they did. They went to Alexandria and planted the church down there, and John Mark matured in the faith, and a few years later, Paul writes and says, would somebody send John Mark to me? He is invaluable to me in ministry. So, some good came out of that conflict that couldn't be resolved. The young man matured and became very useful to the man that one time didn't even want to travel with him. But when we realize that some issues cannot be resolved, What do we do then with the issues that cannot be resolved? When we have worked together in the realm of seeing the great deal of sameness that we have, the great deal of commonality that we have, the shared mutual concerns we have, sometimes that takes enough emotion out of the issue that we can live together differing on it. Okay? Now, any of us who are husbands and wives know there are some issues like that, right? In my System 5 heyday, I was always looking for the most efficient way to do everything. And I decided one day to explain to my wife how to wash and dry the dishes more efficiently. Because she was wasting too much of her time, too much wasted motion, too much space being taken up to do this simple little job of washing and drying the dishes. I have learned to exercise more discretion than that in the years since. I discovered that she was certainly willing for the dishes to be washed efficiently and for me to do it. And so I had to learn that, you know, this is not worth a divorce. It may grate at me that I see all this inefficiency in my own kitchen, but I'm just going to learn to live with that. When we can take some of the emotion out of the artillery positions, we may not be able to settle the issue, but people may be willing and able to live with one another despite the issue and work together despite the issue. And we have those all through our congregation. We have them all through our staff. We have them all through our eldership. Things that we just don't see eye to eye on, and we know we're never going to see eye to eye on. Should we sing songs during the communion service, or should we not sing songs during the communion service? We are never going to settle that one, but we're going to live together. We're going to live together. And some weeks we're going to sing, and some weeks we're not going to sing. And the weeks we sing, we're doing it for those who love the singing. And for those that don't like to sing, we invite them to be patient with the weeks we sing, because we're going to turn around and do it your way very soon. And the people who want to be singing that day, we want them to be supportive of you. In fact, when we started blending our worship service and moving more and more contemporary themes into a congregation that does traditional heritage music very well, we adopted a congregational slogan. Our slogan was, "We're the church that sings one another's songs." And Sunday after Sunday, I would stand there and I'd say, "Now, as you look at the program of worship today, you see we're singing a lot of traditional stuff. Not too many contemporary things today, and a lot of you really like the contemporary music. And you know, next week, we have a service plan that is loaded with a lot of contemporary songs. You're going to want to be back next week." See, I don't want them to say, "Well, they don't sing my music and not come back." We're going to sing your music next week. And we know that when we sing a lot of that music, you want everybody to sing it with the enthusiasm you have for that music. So would it be asking too much if today, while we're singing the music that other people are enriched by, that you sing with the same enthusiasm their music that you're going to want them to sing with next week when we're singing your music? You know, we're the congregation that sings one another's music. And that thing sort of caught on. And there are still people today who will walk up to me and say, "Boy, I really didn't like that song selection." "Oh, yeah. We're the congregation that sings one another's..." Okay. And the thing just sort of quietens down. So we've learned to live together despite the fact we can't resolve the issue. Okay? And sometimes that's the best we can do. Sometimes that's the best we can do. When you get underneath the issue and the problems to the concerns, that's when a lot of the material in our book, System Sensitive Leadership, is going to become very valuable to you. You're going to begin to start understanding what's driving these concerns as people come at issues from different system viewpoints. There's a lot of material we've developed since this book that is not in printed form that has a play on this. System 4 and System 5, for those of you familiar with the terminology of this book, are left brain rewarding systems. Systems 4 and 5 reward left brain activity, logical, analytical, sequential, efficiency, thinking. System 6 is a right brain dominant system. It rewards feeling and intuition and experience. And one of the reasons that we are having so much conflict right now is that we've got Systems 4 and 5, which have basically dominated the church between the two of them ever since it was established on American soil, now trying to coexist with System 6, which is running a right brain agenda instead of a left brain agenda. And that's why they like different music. Someone said to me yesterday, how many times have I heard this? I don't mind singing these contemporary songs, but when we sing a phrase, let's sing it one time and go into something else. Let's not sing it over and over and over and over and over. This lady is a very System 5 lady, and she's reacting to something System 6 loves. They love the experience as it builds, as you reflect on that verse over and over, and you sing it with different tempos and different intensities, and the meaning becomes richer as you experience it more and more. Where is that coming from? It's coming from the right brain that drives System 6, as opposed to the left brain that drives Systems 4 and 5. And you'll pick up on a lot of that as you understand the dynamics of these systems. And you'll see why the tension points are there in such bold relief as we're dealing with problems in the church. Well, being assigned 45 minutes to deal with a topic like this is a study in frustration. I tried to take a lot of things that I could have said and reduce them down to this simple model that I felt like maybe you could take away and keep in mind. That what you're looking for is procedural satisfaction, psychological satisfaction, and product satisfaction. And you go first for the healthy procedure and building psychological satisfaction, and then people will find a way to live more than likely with the product. And learning to get behind the issues and the problems to the concerns so that we can remind ourselves that we really are a whole bunch more alike than we are different. And when we can reestablish that, then we can go to work in a healthier environment to settle the differences that still remain or find a way that we live together despite them. Again today, I brought an extra supply of books I ran out yesterday. If you didn't get one yesterday and you'd like one today, they're $10. They're the same price at College Press Bookstore, bookshop up here if you go by there. If you want to pick one up, feel free to come up after we're through. If you ever need to talk to me by phone, email, or whatever, feel free to get in touch with me. This is a ministry I enjoy being part of helping churches establish the spiritual health that we need to live above the conflict and be the people of peace Christ called us to be. God bless you.